What up, Energy fam? What's going on? Welcome back to the next episode of Primal Alchemy's Red Pill Initiation Hour, here with your host, Chris Story. Alright guys, for everyone that is a returning guest, you definitely 100% know the drill by now. You know there's a few things to cover before we can kick today's episode off. So let's get them out of the way and get to the good shit. So first things first, massive thank you guys. Honestly, I've said it now for the past, I say maybe like 8 episodes or so, so that's the past month, that you guys are really starting to help me out. You're giving me loads of feedback on this. I'm getting more and more people by the day just popping into my emails, my DMs on Instagram, leaving me reviews on iTunes. And it's great. It's great to hear from you guys. I love being able to talk to each and every one of you that reaches out to me, letting me know what you think, what your favorite episode was, what it was that you liked about it, what information you want covered in upcoming episodes. And it's really good to hear from you guys. Honestly, I love to communicate with anyone who reaches out. Honest, it's amazing. It makes this all worth it for me. So please, if you do enjoy this podcast, then after you finish this episode, just hit me up. Jump over to Instagram, Primal Alchemy UK, and just be open. Tell me what you think. Or if you could, leave me a review on iTunes. And that would be amazing as well. That really allows me to expand and increase my reach and visibility with the podcast as a whole. So yes, that would be massively appreciated as well. So what I always do, guys, if this is your first time listening, I always drop an exclusive 10% discount code just for you being here right now. So that's going to be the code REDPILL. That's the code REDPILL that when used at checkout on primalalchemy.co.uk, you get 10% off anything within the shopping basket at the time of purchase. So again, guys, if this is your first introduction to the brand, first time hearing my voice, then this is the perfect opportunity to use this code, jump over to our website, and check out our Vitruvian Protein. That's our flagship organic whey protein superfood blend. It's the only product, the only superfood powder in the world to be certified organic, keto, and paleo simultaneously. Yeah, it's really good, guys. Give it a try. We've had some amazing feedback recently from the other people that have been listening that have taken advantage of the offer and bought themselves a few packs. And yeah, it's amazing, guys. Forged with adaptogenic, nootropic, prebiotic herbs, high vibrational superfoods, all of which I source myself in order to create for you what I believe to be the best superfood powder on the market. Honestly, I don't think there's no comparison to it. And then if you're not in the market for a protein powder at this moment, then we also have our Ancestral Potential coaching programs. And these are our programs in which we create for you exercise, nutritional, biohacking, esoteric, spirituality, self-mastery coaching. Quite a bit. So plenty of things on there for you to check out. Anyway. Moving on to today's episode. Today's episode is with Dr. Sean Baker. Quite the name. Quite the A-list name within this industry, guys. So it was really great to have Sean on. So Sean is a big name within the, really the movement which he created, essentially. Or at least brought it to the masses, quote unquote, which is the carnivore movement, which if none of you are familiar with that, it's a all meat based diet, which is an extreme elimination diet, but very closely mimics our natural evolutionary ancestral diet. And Sean doesn't mix his words. He, as we say, says what he means and means what he says. He is Yeah, quite the force to be reckoned with. He's got science that he uses, obviously, from his profession that puts a lot of credit to everything he says. And yeah, you know what, guys, let's just jump in and see if you enjoy this one. Again, if you do enjoy this, reach out to myself and Sean. All of Sean's details are in the show notes. And hopefully this one will be beneficial for you. It might be something a little bit different or almost come across as quite alien to begin with. But yeah, listen to what Sean's got to say, and he presents the information very well, and it was great to talk to him. So hopefully you enjoyed this chat just as much as I did. And as always, Morpheus, tell these fools what's up.
You take the blue pill, the story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
As above, so below. What lies without resides within. Time for growth to begin. Mental, physical, and spiritual. We find balance with all three as we focus on totality. The whole, not the half. This is for those on a spiritual path. Looking for the clues to the answers of life. But the truth ain't always nice, so leave your ego at the door. Let your inner lion roar and your spirit soar. As we go deep down to the molecular level, tap into the body with some yogic breath. Throw in some calisthenics for a true strength test. Like the shamans of old, we use the nature to heal. With a little bit of DMT to reveal. This whole life journey is a little surreal. And your mind needs a leader, not a follower in life. Let your mind be the master and you pay a hefty price. This next 60 minutes is about self mastery. It's not an easy path and it's a lifelong journey, but we up to empower with this red pill initiation hour. With this red pill initiation hour, brought to you by Primer Open Me.
The Matrix is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
Three, two, one. Oh shit, guys, we're back. Sweet Odin, we're back. It's episode 43 of the Red Pill Initiation Hour, and today we are going deep. You guys know by now my viewpoints on nutrition. You know that I'm deep into the ancestral health, ancestral eating, that sort of protocol in alignment with eating in accordance to our ancestors. And a big part that has to play within that equation is meat. And very recently there has been, very, I'd say probably from last year, 2018, now it's really starting to pick up steam, is the movement of the carnivore diet. And I've had Dominic Rapson on before. Don't know if this is your first time or if this is a recurring podcast for you. That we covered this briefly, but I wanted to go balls deep on this one and get the main man on himself. I wanted to get the king of the carnivore diet. And yeah, luckily and fortunately, he's given us an hour or so of his day in order to break down this shit and really sort of enlighten the masses with, yeah, the effects of eating carnivore diet. So yeah, I just want to give a massive thanks and welcome to Mr. Sean Baker. Sean, thanks for coming on, man.
Yeah, Chris, it's a pleasure being here. I'm looking forward to delving into this stuff, answering some questions, and see where we go.
Yeah, for sure, Sean. So, again, I did entitle you then and knighted you the king of the carnivore diet. But for many of people that are listening, they may not be aware of what that even means. So I was wondering if you could just give us a little bit of a background on yourself, what you're about, because you're so much more than the king of the carnivore diet. Of course, that's kind of who you have become at this very moment, but you've got quite a rich history and doctor and everything. It's totally legit, and I'd love for you to give us breakdown of your background and how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, so I am I'm 52 years old. I've been a lifelong athlete. I was trained as an orthopedic surgeon, spent a couple decades as a surgeon, had a period of time where I had to surrender my medical license because what I was doing was providing lifestyle advice rather than surgery. Had a long fight about that. Finally got my license restored when they realized that there was nothing wrong with what I was doing, but it took a couple of years out of my life to do that. In the interim, you know, I kind of delved into nutrition, which I'd started about almost a decade ago, you know, as I got into my early to mid 40s and I started seeing that my health wasn't what it should be, despite the fact that I was still training, exercising very, you know, very rigorously, you know, daily. I was still training like a, you know, like someone competing at high level athletics, which I was doing, but my health was starting to falter. And so then I started playing with diet, went through a whole range of diets, starting with a, you know, an almost vegetarian, low fat, high fiber, high vegetable, you know, just a little bit of lean meat diet. And, you know, I managed to lose weight doing that, got leaner with that, but I found it wasn't sustainable, didn't feel particularly good. Then I switched into a more, I think, suitable diet. I went on to kind of a paleo primal style diet for a while, kind of got into more and more reading about the nutritional literature, and then started experimenting with low carb and finally ketogenic diets, which I'd done for several years. And then finally I, you know, stumbled onto a carnivore diet, which, you know, I know it's kind of funny that I've been the most vocal proponent of this, but there's a lot of people that kind of were in the space prior to me. But anyway, I did that, and I've been on a, you know, what we would call a carnivore diet now for almost 2.5 years, and continue to do well athletically. My health continues to improve. I continue to, you know, thrive this way. And I think if we wanted to say what is a carnivore diet, you know, it's kind of evolving, because there's, you know, we get this sort of, what I find is we're still learning a lot. And I think the best way I would like to describe it now is I would call it a whole food meat-based diet, which looks to you know, get the basis of the nutrition from animal source nutrition, and then plants are minimized or eliminated as needed, you know, based upon health results. And I think for some people, that means a strict no plant food diet. For some people, it means, you know, limited amounts or using them judiciously. But I think at the bottom line, it's a diet that is heavy in meat, and it's meat based. And I think that is probably, you know, at least what clinically appears to happen is people get the best results doing that. You know, and again, how strict they need to be is going to vary from person to person.
Yeah, that's an overview. Yeah, that's great. And it's, I've done a little bit of research into the carnivore diet myself. It's almost in essence an elimination diet to begin with, and in terms of getting all the other shit out of your system. And I had some pretty good results from it. Like nowadays, I would say mine's a little bit more flexible, but it's predominantly, yeah, kind of carnivore diet. I try to keep things seasonal. I think that's important as well. Try to keep your metabolic machinery intact, fat adapted is important, which obviously being in a, or following a carnivore diet rule set, you pretty much go hand in hand. And there's obviously a lot of backlash to the carnivore diet. We seem to have two extremes. You've got the militant vegans on one side, and then we have the rise of the carnivore sort of family on the other side. And it's an interesting dynamic at play. And what's your go-to points for people that are kind of in the in-between, where they hear a lot of the vegan propaganda coming through? What's your sort of points to be made about what's the sort of, not that I want you to sell this to anyone, but what's the main benefits of going fully carnivore?
Well, I think what we have to understand is, you know, you shouldn't have to sell a diet. And, you know, one of the problems with nutrition in general is we just don't have very good nutritional research, despite what people say, to tell us what we're supposed to eat. Most of it is based on, you know, epidemiologic studies, which in no way can show us what we're supposed to eat. And so a lot of these arguments that are made in the name of science are really not grounded upon much. And so I would say, go ahead and try whatever. You know, if you want to try a vegan diet, go ahead and try it. You know, don't get attached to the ethical side of that. You know, do it for health reasons, and then try another type of diet. And it may be a carnivorous diet, and see where you go. I mean, the whole point of this carnivorous diet is not some ideology. It's about finding what works well for you, and see what your results are. You know, I don't care what diet someone's on. If no other people in the world went on this diet, it wouldn't bother me at all. What I do want to see is people, you know, aggressively pursuing the lifestyle interventions that are going to help their health instead of depending upon a medical system that largely is only going to be treating symptoms and only putting band-aids on problems. So we really have to look at what works for you. And so, I mean, when we look about, you know, people saying that meat is problematic in the diet, well, they've never really studied meat in the diet. I mean, what they do is they study people, large groups of people that are eating a little bit of meat. You know, even the U.S. diet, the average person only eats 3 ounces of red meat a day. I mean, that's a small, tiny sliver of the U.S. diet. The rest of it comes from grain, seed oils, sugar. You know, it's like, you know, 70% of the diet is just this garbage food. And so we've got this whole sort of science built on not even studying what we're supposed to be studying. And so when we look at people that are on a meat heavy diet or a whole food meat based diet or healthy conscientious meat eaters, that population has never really been studied. What we are seeing is that people that adopt this lifestyle unequivocally get healthier for the most part. And so I think that kind of shows you what the real effects of eating meat are, rather than these speculations based on, you know, studies where meat is only a small part of the diet.
Yeah, it's one of those things that it's always been a bit of a thorn in the side when it comes to nutritional sciences. It's just that people don't really understand the actual process of how scientific studies are, how research is actually done, and all of the other variables that contribute to being able to do research in the first place, and where the money's coming from, the vetted interests that are involved within the study itself. And it's one of, and yeah, people always like point, where's the research? Where's the research? And it's not always about the research. And one of the things I'd like to ask you is, obviously being quite a vocal, yeah, quite a voice within the sort of carnivore community, I'm guessing you get a lot of people reach out to you and tell you their own sort of anecdotal sort of experience with this. And what's the main things, what's the feedback you've had? Like, what sort of things have people been getting back to you with in terms of improvement to their health and full spectrum, anything?
Yeah, so I, you know, what I'd like to say is, you know, and I get a lot, literally thousands and almost on a daily basis, you know, a half dozen people a day telling me how their life has improved dramatically with this. And equally, there's people that have issues, particularly transitioning. We can talk about that as well. But I mean, as far as the benefits, it seem to be occurring pretty regularly. We do see many people talking about improvements in mental health outlook, whether it's improvements in depressive symptoms or symptoms with anxiety. That's clearly occurring. We see all kinds of people talking about improvements in digestive health. We see a lot of people talking about things like pain going away, particularly musculoskeletal pain like arthritis, tendonitis, those types of things. We're seeing people improve their blood, normalizing their blood pressure. They're seeing their diabetes, you know, dramatically getting better. Their blood sugar becomes very stable. Their insulin sensitivity gets better. Inflammation improves. Skin issues improve. Things like psoriasis, eczema, acne, you know, other dermatitis issues tend to go away. A whole bunch of autoimmune type symptoms improve. Women seem to notice improvement in their fertility, their menstrual cycle. You know, lots of people lose weight, get leaner, get stronger. I mean, it's in general, it seems to improve most conditions for most people. Now, not everybody gets 100% relief, and some people it occurs slowly. Some people gain weight. Some people, you know, have a difficult time with the transition. Some people can't stick to it. I mean, it's not, there's a lot of hype out there, but there's a lot of, I think, good stuff is actually happening. And so it's something that I think long-term, hopefully we can get some studies on this. We have to remember that there are exactly zero diets out there that have ever been studied over the long-term in a truly randomized controlled fashion. It's never been done. So there's no diet out there we can say has great data on. All it is, you know, basically speculation based on this long-term population data where you just, you know, you ask people to try to remember what diet they ate. You know, how many blueberries did you eat in the last 6 months? I mean, who knows that stuff? Nobody. So, I mean, it's just wild speculation. So there's never going to be, I mean, unless somebody comes up with, you know, $1 billion to research this stuff, and you have volunteers that are willing to live for 50 years in a metabolic ward and have every aspect of their life controlled, it's just not going to happen. So we have to either assume that this epidemiology can tell us what to do, and I really don't think that's the case, or we can assume that these short-term studies that are sort of, we're able to look at biomarkers, you know, things like blood lipids and you know, different levels are adequate to tell us how long we're going to live, which I also would argue is not the case. And so, but in general, those are the things that we see getting better. And I literally, you know, I put that up on meatheals.com. That represents a tiny fraction of the stuff that I get sent every day of people getting better. So it's really, it's exciting for me to see this stuff. And, you know, for a certain segment of the population, it seems to dramatically improve their health. What that percentage is, it's too early to say. I don't know yet, but it does seem to be a very significant percentage.
Yeah, with the, I mean, I guess what the skeptic viewpoint would be, it's that is the health effects, the beneficial health effects that are being sort of documented through this anecdotal evidence, is that from the meat itself, or is that through the elimination of the sugar, of the industrialized seed oils, the hydrogenated fats, everything like that? From your point of view, what's the actual healing qualities of the meat? Like, what is it that's in the meat that's going to be that we need?
Yeah, well, I think, to be fair, I think it's a combination of both things. I mean, I think that there is a lot of garbage in the human diet, in the modern human diet, and you know, we can argue about what that is. Some people say it's sugar, some people will say it's refined processed carbohydrates, some people will say it's these industrial seed oils which entered the diet about 100 years ago. I think it's all of the above with regard to what's bad for us. Now, there are some whole plant foods that are certainly going to be less problematic, and maybe not problematic at all for many people when you compare those things. So just by eliminating all that garbage, it's, you know, there's a lot of diets out there. You can do a vegan diet and still eat junk food. You can do a ketogenic diet and still eat junk food. It's very difficult to do a carnivore diet and eat that junk food. Now, when we talk about what's in meat, well, we know without beyond a shadow of a doubt that the nutrition and the nutrients that are found in meat or dairy or eggs or whatever you want to say are much more bioavailable, and they're more appropriate for what humans need. I mean, this is what we are, you know, I mean, just to kind of put it bluntly, I mean, you and I are made out of red meat. I mean, that's, you know, I've operated on thousands of people. When you cut people open, they're made out of red meat. So when we're talking about how do you build the structure that's necessary to, you know, keep a human maintained and running, the ingredients are the same thing. You know, that's why when people eat a lot of beef in their diet or lamb or some other red meat in the diet, which many people on a carnivore do, I think it's just very efficient. You know, you wouldn't build a car, you know, you wouldn't build a car out of tree parts. You know, you'd build a car out of metal and the appropriate materials. Or, you know, you wouldn't build a house, you wouldn't build a brick house out of straw. You know, you'd want bricks. And so it's the same thing. You know, meat is more efficient from a nutritional standpoint. It also tends to be very easy on the digestive system. Despite the sort of vegan propaganda that meat rots in your colon, that's complete fallacy. It's incredibly well tolerated. It's incredibly well absorbed in the small intestine, as opposed to plants, which are very much more difficult to digest, more difficult to absorb nutrition from. They come with all sorts of anti-nutrients and other compounds which interfere with nutrient mineral absorption. And so it's more efficient, and it avoids all the junk food. And I would argue that all humans have a pretty good capacity to absorb, you know, meat in particular, just because we've been doing it for about 3 million years now. A counter argument could be made that, you know, prior to evolving into, you know, humans or homo, you know, homo erectus, homo habilis, you know, homo sapien, whatever you want to call humans, we were eating fruits and some of these other things. That's likely true. And I think we still do have some capacity to deal with fruits in small quantities. However, some people, if their metabolic problems are problematic, you know, they've lost the capacity to deal with much sugar, those things become an issue for people.
Yeah, that's it totally ties into my sort of outlook on cyclical dietary sort of
philosophy, which is in the winter, we would have been ancestrally, we would have predominantly lived off animal fats, organ meats, and very rare seasonal veg. So we would have been deep into ketosis in the winter. And then as we moved into the summer or spring summer, when depending where you are on Earth and you've got a little bit more vegetation and fruits began to grow, you would have had that, but very, very scarcely. It wouldn't have been much at all. And then the increased carbohydrate intake, the increased sugar intake that you would have had from the fruits, from the veg itself, it would have been mitigated from the increase in vitamin D from the sun, which is going to affect the glucose, your sort of your resistance and sensitivity to the to insulin. So I think that's very important. Like you said, I think some people get the wrong idea maybe, or they only see the extreme end of the carnivore diet instead of looking at it from a more rational mind of what the message is that you're giving out. And one of the main things that people seem to get triggered by is when they think of the carnivore diet and they think that everyone should just be eating meat all the time. The first image that comes to their mind is like the generic image of like the conditions of factory farming and the issues that, and yeah, the whole ethics of that. And they're saying that it's unsustainable. Not everyone can just eat meat all the time. And what's your sort of response to that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very lengthy, long topic. And I spent a lot of time with that, you know, and I think that we have to sort of realize that there's a lot of nuance in the way our food is made, you know, whether it's plant food or animal food, there are negatives and positives about both. I mean, there's no crop on earth that's raised where there are not environmental issues. There's lots of animal death that goes into raising any crop. There's pesticides, there's runoff, there's residues. There's carbon footprint for anything. You know, in fact, if we want to look at just straight up CO2, carbon dioxide, plant harvesting has a much greater footprint. You know, when we're talking about just the molecule CO2. Now, the concern with animals is methane. Methane is by far emitted more from animal agriculture than it is plant agriculture. But again, methane is a very short-lived greenhouse gas, and so its impact on long-term climate change is largely not very much at all. And so I just had a nice discussion with Professor Frank Mitlauner from UC Davis about this. And so, but as far as, you know, how these animals are treated, you know, that's going to vary from place to place. If if we look at sort of these vegan propaganda films where they show the worst of the worst, they often go to these third world countries and show things like, these slaughter techniques, maybe halal slaughter techniques or other techniques where the animal looks to be distressed. And we can contrast that to what's actually going on day to day in the US and probably the UK and Australia and other of these developed countries, when it's a very humane, you know, realizing that these animals still have to be killed, it's a very humane slaughter process. I mean, these animals die instantly. It's within a few milliseconds. Now we talk about how are these animals raised. I like to talk about cattle just because I have more knowledge on cattle, because that's kind of what I eat. And that's what I spent my time with. I spend time talking and interacting with ranchers all the time. And so you realize that these animals spend the vast majority of their life out in pasture, roaming around, you know, and you know, worldwide, 99% of all cattle on earth right now are on pasture. I mean, that's a fact. 1% of the cattle in the world right now at any given time are in a feedlot. That's primarily in the United States, where we have about 14 million cattle in feedlots at any one time of the 93 million cattle we have, you know, in the U.S. And so if you talk about the feedlots and the cattle, even if you don't like that system, you think it's wrong, those animals still are not being shoved in boxes. They have by law 200 square feet per animal, the size of a large room that they have to walk around out in their pasture, in their fenced off area. They don't even use all that air because they're herd animals. If you go to Africa, and I've been to Africa, and you look at these great wild ruminant herds, the wildebeest, you know, the buffalo and that stuff, they all cluster together. They stand right next to each other. That's their natural instinct. And they do that because that's how they look out for predators. And so these animals, even in feedlots, and again, we're going to distinguish between cattle and chicken and pigs, but when we talk about cattle, their life is pretty good for a ruminant animal. You know, if we talk about what a ruminant animal is, and ruminants are things like cows and goats and sheep and deer and, you know, antelope and elk. A ruminant in the wild, you know, if we take the U.S. white-tailed deer population, for instance, and that's the largest ruminant animal in the United States, 50% of those animals, before they reach 12 weeks of age, will be killed. And they will either die from starvation, disease, or most often they will be killed by predators. They will be ripped apart while still alive and eaten while they're still alive. And so that is the normal fate of one of these animals. And so we contrast that to what we do with cattle, and we raise cattle, and 96% of those cattle will make it to adulthood, and they will live in a safe environment, free from predation. They will be fed every day. They will have a good life. And then when the time is up, when they're 16 months or 2 years up or 2.5 years up, if they're, you know, on grass, they'll die. But I mean, their life is still much better than they would experience in a wild. They wouldn't even exist if humans don't have a need to eat them. I mean, the bottom line is humans have a biological and nutritional requirement for eating meat. I mean, I know the vegans are going to disagree with that, but that's the fact. And we're going to continue to do that. We're going to continue to do that for all time, you know, and we just need to figure out the ways to make it the most sustainable way to do it. Now, could we, this is an interesting statistic. So if, you know, in Western developed nations, you know, in the United States in particular, but in places like the UK, we've gotten very efficient at producing cattle for meat. And, you know, if we compare, you know, if we were to make a comparison, like most of the cattle, if we look at like India has the second largest herd of cattle in the world. So the biggest herd of cattle in the world is in Brazil. They've got about 220 million. India has about 190 million. The next biggest is China, I believe. The U.S. is in fourth with 93 million. China has about 120 million. And then Ethiopia has the fifth largest herd in the world with about 50, 60 million cattle. But if we look at the way cattle are raised throughout most of the world, like India, their entire herd is infected with parasites. They're skinny. They're sickly. The same thing can be said of much of Asia, much of Africa. And so if you were just to fix their health problems, give them some medicine to get rid of those parasites, improve their breeding practice so you bred cattle that produce more meat, if you were to take care of their nutrition so they're fed appropriately, you could literally double the world's output of meat with the same number of cattle that you have now. You could feed the projected 10 billion people, 10 billion people that are going to be on this earth by 2050, the same amount of meat that we eat now, you know, and not increase a single cow. In fact, you could do that with half as many cows as we have now if you were to raise those efficiency standards. So if the rest of the world were to raise your efficiency standards to what we have in the United States, we could have 50% of the cows and feed just as all the people, all 10 billion people in 2050. So that is doable. So it's not a matter of could we do it, it's a matter of if we want to do it or not.
It's interesting. And with the another factor that plays into this is the quality of the meat itself. And obviously there is quite the demand now for grass-fed, grass-finished meat. And how severe is the importance for you when it comes to quality of the meat that you're ingesting? Does that actually make a difference to you? Like, does it matter if the cow has been raised in a factory farm and been fed genetically modified corn feed, or compared to a cow that's been raised, pasture raised, and grass fed, grass finished its whole life? Is there a difference in that for you or not?
Yeah. So this is a question that I think you have to look at on many levels. And I think that, when we look at it from a environmental sustainability issue, when we look at it from an ethical standpoint, I think you can make an argument that, you know, more cows, I think clearly, regardless of how they're finished, more cows need to be on grass. We need more cows that, you know, I just had a conversation with Alan Savory, and clearly we need to get more animals in the pastures to reclaim these pastures from what's becoming desert. So we need more animals. We need them on grass. We need them to be pastured correctly, regardless of how they're finished. Again, from an ethical standpoint, most people would say they prefer to see the animals in the fields and in the pastures than in a feedlot. And I certainly understand that point. Now, when it comes to human health, certainly grass-finished beef has compounds and nutrients in there in greater quantities for many of them that we think are beneficial to humans. We don't know that for sure, but we think so. One of those would be things like conjugated linoleic acid, which has been demonstrated to at least be effective in preventing heart disease. You know, things like zinc, things like vitamin A, vitamin E, omega-3 fatty acids, all those things are thought to be beneficial to human health. And certainly they are in a higher quantity in grass-finished versus grain-finished beef. Grain-finished beef has a higher percentage of monounsaturated fats. Some people think monounsaturated fats are better. You know, there's not been really many clinical trials done in humans comparing the two. In fact, the only two I'm aware of were done around 2010 by Texas A&M University. And they looked at people eating grain-finished versus grass-finished hamburger meat, and they just compared some biomarkers. It was HDL, LDL, triglycerides, and I think they looked at their blood pressure. And the difference between them was not much difference at all. But they were slightly actually in favor of the grain-finished beef, showing a slightly improvement in HDL, maybe a little bit better improvement in blood pressure, but not enough to really make a difference. Now, what happens, you know, as I've seen literally thousands of people do this diet, and I ask them what kind of beef do they eat, and I really can't discern a difference between those eating grass-finished versus those eating grain-finished in the type of results they're getting. It seems like regardless of, you know, what type of beef you're going to eat, the results are going to universally be good. Did I lose you? Okay.
No, you're back.
The, you know, the difference may be that for certain individuals, they feel better on a grass-finished product. I've certainly seen people tell me that. I have seen people say they feel better the other way, you know, and so it's, you know, I'd like to just say, yes, we should all be eating grass-finished beef. And I think from a ethical standpoint, from an environmental standpoint, and it's not quite as black and white as that, but just in general, I'd love to say, yes, we should all be eating grass-finished beef. It's better for our health. But I have to be honest and say what I'm actually seeing and observing. Now, maybe we can do tests. There was a gal that a friend of mine that did this test. She did a 1 month of grass-finished beef and 1 minute of grain-finished beef. And she looked at a lot of lab tests. She looked at omega-3 indices and some of those other things, EPA, DHA levels, and really didn't see much difference at all when she did her blood tests. She saw the grass-finished beef was slightly improved in those markers, but not significant. Not anything where you can say, wow, it's a dramatic difference. And so, again, while I'd like to say, you know, from, you know, like I said, an environmental and ethical standpoint, we should be eating grass-finished if we can. I can't really support that by true health data yet. Maybe later on down the road, as we get more funding and research for the stuff, we can make that argument. Right now, it doesn't seem to be a big difference. I need to point out that I think regardless if you eat grass-finished or grain-finished beef, it's still going to be far, far better for you than it is going to be most of the stuff that's in the supermarket, particularly for eating processed food and other garbage. So I'd rather you spend your money, if you only have a few dollars or pounds to spend, I'd rather you do it on cheaper meat and not eat the garbage processed food, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's great, man. And another thing, Sean, so it's, again, closely related to the previous question with the grain-fed and grass-fed meat is, what's your opinion on bovine somatotropin? So it's obviously the growth hormone that's going to be in the meat itself. Is that something that's an issue?
Well, I mean, you know, there's a general sort of thought about, you know, these hormones and antibiotics that these animals get. Some get them, some grass-finished animals doesn't necessarily mean they're not going to get an antibiotic. You know, if your dog or your kid gets sick, you're going to want to give them medication. And so these animals are still going to be exposed to that regardless of the finishing method. So those are independent questions. But as far as, you know, growth hormones, as far as estrogens and testosterone and other hormones that are given to promote growth in those animals, you know, if we look at the concentrations that show up in the meat, it's incredibly small amounts. And, you know, just in general, you know, if we want to look at things like estrogens, which are compounds that are given to these animals, You know, if we, I just saw a nice graphic, like if we were to look at an 8 ounce sirloin steak coming from a grass finished animal that doesn't have an implant, that wasn't given hormones, the amount of estrogen you're going to get in there is about 3 nanograms, which is a tiny, tiny, tiny amount. So you're going to get some estrogen regardless, but it's going to be a tiny, tiny amount. But if the animal was implanted with hormones, then that amount goes from 3 nanograms up to 5 nanograms, which is, again, still an incredibly, incredibly small amount. And so I don't get too excited about that stuff. I mean, if you're really worried about hormones, I mean, don't eat organ meats, because organ meats are going to have higher amounts of hormones. Don't eat eggs. Don't eat dairy. They're going to have higher amounts of hormones. You know, we can make, if you want to make the argument about phytoestrogens, and my gosh, the amounts of phytoestrogens are thousands of times greater than you'd see in meat. So again, we have to, I think we have to put things in big perspective and not worry about the tiny, tiny, tiny things that make a small, tiny amount. I'd rather you eat, you know, 5 nanograms of estrogen in beef than you eat an Oreo cookie. I mean, people get so hung up on the tiny, tiny minutia when it's the big picture stuff. You know, it's like, going to the gym and you know, doing wrist curls when you should be squatting. I mean, it's such a, you know, I hate to minimize this stuff, but I have to say, you gotta look at the big picture overall and say, oh, I'm not going to eat meat because, you know, if you can afford, you know, the finest cut of meat in the world that is free of antibiotics and grass finished, and has no hormones, and it's treated well, and it's perfect, and it came from, you know, an area where there was no pollution and no pesticides in the air, and it was, you know, raised maybe in the Himalayas, then do so. But that's not practical for most people. That's not realistic for most people. I mean, if you live, I don't know where you live, but if you live in London, you're exposed to tons of pollution every day. At some point you have to say, okay, what can I control? What can I not control? What is important for me to worry about, and what is important for me not to worry about? And again, it's, you know, this worry about the 99% stuff, not the 0.1% stuff.
It's interesting. Your take on that. It's interesting. I wanted to clear that up with you and just get your thoughts on that. And with your day-to-day diet then, Sean, what is your day-to-day sort of eating regime actually look like?
Yeah, so for me, and again, this is, I don't necessarily say people need to emulate what I do. I do what I do because it allows me to feel and function best. As you may or may not know, I just won the world championships in indoor rowing for the 50 plus class. And I, you know, I beat everybody in the field by, you know, a huge margin. You know, I'm doing extremely well athletically and health wise. I eat typically about almost 2 kilos of beef a day. That's my diet. I mean, typically two meals. I'd say 25% of my diet comes from grass finished sources. 75% of it comes from conventional supermarket beef, or other, not always. I get it from ranchers that are, you know, direct from ranches that, are still grain finished, but you know, well-treated animals. I mean, to add to that, I'll sometimes have some dairy, not much. Sometimes I'll have some yogurt. Sometimes I'll have a little bit of cheese, but not very frequently. I don't do as well with dairy. Sometimes I'll have seafood. You know, there's periods of time where I'll eat a bunch of salmon. Sometimes I'll have eggs. You know, I'll add some eggs to that. But in general, I would say 98% of my diet is some sort of red meat, typically beef, sometimes lamb. Every once in a while, I'll have a little bit of bacon. This pork, I don't eat a lot of pork. I rarely, almost never eat chicken. And that's it. And I don't use a lot of organ meats. I know there's some controversy. Some people think you have to eat organ meats. I'm not convinced that's the case. Perhaps for some people, it's very important. I cook my meat. You know, I know there's a lot of people out there that think you have to eat it raw. I don't know that's true either. I mean, I've literally done extremely well eating cooked meat for several years now. I'm aware of literally lots and lots of other people in the same situation. So it's, again, I don't try to get too dogmatic about this stuff. I think, you know, would I add something else to my diet? Sure. I mean, do I want to? No, not really. I mean, you know, like if I were to add something back in, it would likely be some fruit. I mean, that's what I would do. But, you know, but it served me well. I mean, I enjoy the food. I look forward to every meal. I don't get sick of it. I don't worry about the fact that it's the same old thing every day. Because quite honestly, I'm not eating for entertainment. I'm eating for nutrition. And, you know, I'm pretty good at cooking a steak right now, so it tastes pretty damn good. You know?
I'd hope so as well, Sean. I hope you've got a lot of experience.
Yeah.
One of the other things as well, I mean, for someone who's listening to this and they've just taken note of what you eat in the day, if you just finished your fancy nutrition course and you come out and now you're a qualified nutritionist, the first thing you'd say is, where are you getting your fiber from? And yeah. I know what your views are on it, but I just want you to kind of break that down on what is fiber essential for us?
Well, I mean, you know, like I said, essential to me, the definition of essential means if you don't have it, you die. So if you don't have certain amino acids, you die. If you don't have certain fats, you die. If you don't have certain vitamins, you die. You will not die without fiber. Now, there's an argument that, you know, maybe it's beneficial. There's certainly a lot of people that believe fiber is helpful. Again, most of that data comes from nutritional epidemiology, where we see people that eat more fiber have a better health outcome. Now, the question becomes, does fiber intake, is that merely just a proxy for other healthier behaviors? You know, people that eat more fiber tend to not eat as much refined processed carbohydrates and that sort of stuff. They tend to not drink as many sugar sweetened beverages. They tend to exercise more. They tend to smoke less. And so this data saying that fiber is essential is really saying fiber intake is a proxy marker for people that have healthy behaviors. I think that's really what it is. You know, not haven't had any fiber in my diet for 2.5 years now, I've had nothing bad happen to me. I mean, if anything else, my health has gotten better. I mean, the reported benefits of fiber, you know, we can sort of look through those. You know, fiber is believed and is shown in some actual interventional trials that it can slightly lower cholesterol. Is lowering cholesterol even a good thing? I think that's highly debatable, and I think it's context dependent. Fiber can be shown to decrease the rise in glucose postprandially. So if you eat a meal if you drink apple juice versus eating an apple has fiber, apple juice does not. If you drink apple juice, your blood sugar will go up high. If you eat an apple, your blood sugar will go up more slowly. If you're on a diet which doesn't involve eating carbohydrates, which an all-meat diet, you know, is certainly that, then that fiber mitigating your glucose response is basically a moot point. The biggest sort of thing now is people talk about, well, fiber is so important for the gut microbiome, and you need that because these bacteria, you know, evolve these short chain fatty acids like butyrate that can feed and nourish the colonic epithelial cells, right? The problem with that is we already know that protein does the exact same thing. Amino acids can be acted upon by bacteria in the gut to also eliminate short-chain fatty acids, things like isobutyrate, methylbutyrate, and some others. We also know that ketones will also nourish those colonic epithelial cells. And so, again, this whole sort of thing that fiber is essential to the gut microbiome, and I'd just like to say, we know so little about the gut microbiome that we're out there trying to make these proclamations about what the right thing is so far in advance of the actual knowledge that we have. It's just ridiculous. It's preposterous that we think that we can tell people exactly what they're supposed to eat based on gut microbiome, because we don't know anything about it. We're just scratching the surface of that. And these people out there that are trying to sell you probiotics and prebiotics and supplements based on this limited knowledge, it's basically just a money grab. It's basically a scam. It's not going to really likely help anybody. In my view, it's just another distraction in taking us away from, you know, really figuring out what's healthy for us. You know, if your belief of being healthy revolves around what your cholesterol level is, what your ketone levels, or what your microbiome levels are, then I think you have a very distorted view of what being healthy is about. Health is about function. It's about physical abilities. It's about how your systems run. It's about how your digestion works, how your joints feel, how your skin is, what your libido is like, what your sexual function is like, what your mood's like. You know, what your physical capacity is, what your level of happiness. That's what health should be about, and really what it is about. And we get distracted by all this, again, minutia, which is just not serving anybody well except for selling supplements and really, really leading people astray.
Interesting. How have you found, just to pick up on one of those points, have you found a difference in your libido? Obviously, being the age that you are now, have you seen a difference in your testosterone levels since going in full on this carnivore diet?
Yeah. So again, this is another interesting topic. So just over since I've been on a carnivore diet, my libido is excellent. I wake up every day with an erection every single morning. I have no difficulties whatsoever in the sexual areas. You know, as far as clinical signs of testosterone function, I mean, I'm 110 kilograms. I'm lean, I'm muscular. I have, very good strength capacity. I mean, my athletic performance is fine. And so by every clinical indication of testosterone function, I'm doing well. Hang on, just a second.
Sorry, no worries, man. That's cool.
Hey, guys. Yeah, we got guys working around the house today, and so it's just trying to keep these dogs from barking at the workers is tough. Just as far as clinical testosterone function has been excellent. That's been the report I've seen for the vast majority of people on a carnivorous diet. You know, I had a lot of criticism because I took a testosterone test last year. My testosterone level was relatively low. This came 2 days after an extremely hard workout, which we know will lower testosterone. I took it a week later and it was a normal level. Mm-hmm. It's not something, again, I don't really like to dwell on these lab values as much as I do like to talk about what's actually happening clinically, which is, I think this is the thing that I think a lot of people are lost in. You know, people are sort of getting a little bit of knowledge and they think they know what these lab values mean, but they don't realize you have to put things in clinical perspective. Any physician worth a damn understands that labs are a tool that you can use to potentially assess the situation, but you have to understand what's going on clinically. You know, you can't, you can't use those numbers and expect them to mean something without having the overall picture in place. And so I realize that a lot of people like to talk about blood tests, but we have to realize how useful they are, how relatively not useful they are. You know, we understand that blood shows us what's going on, what's traveling in that blood at the exact second in time you had the blood test. We have to realize that these things change, you know, not only weekly, but daily, even on an hour-to-hour basis. And so any one lab test drawn at a particular time may be completely different 2 days later. And so you have to really, realize that when we're talking about health. And that's why, like I said, I prefer to look at long-term results, what's going on, with your body long-term, what can you see? And body composition is a pretty good marker. I mean, if you are obese and have a lot of visceral body fat, a lot of liver fat, that indicates long-term that some bad things are going on. Conversely, if you are lean, muscular, you don't have a lot of visceral fat, that probably indicates good things are happening long term, but it's not going to show up in a blood test necessarily.
Mm. So apart from your dietary sort of protocols, what's your training like? Like, I've always been interested to talk to you about this. What sort of training are you up to nowadays?
Yeah. So, I mean, it depends if I'm competing for sports, I'm going to train specifically for that sport. So with rowing, I do a lot of rowing, but I mean, in general, I've been training for 40 years, and I think having, been a high-level rugby player, a power lifter, and a strongman competitor, a Highland Games world champion, and now a rowing world champion, I think you have to put a lot of different pieces in the puzzle and maintain those, particularly as you get older. I'm in my 50s, but I'm still out running sprints. I'm still jumping. I'm still dunking basketballs. I'm still, being able to move and jump and sprint. I think you have to do some dedicated strength training, which involves, basic heavy compound movement, squats, bench press, deadlift, pressing, some of the hypertrophy work to maintain muscle mass. So that would be more of your traditional bodybuilding style stuff where you're doing, sets to failure and higher rep sets, supersets and things of that nature. I think that conditioning is extremely important. I do quite a bit of high intensity interval training. And I find that, I do a lot of explosive work. So a lot of jumping, throwing, sprinting, and I combine all those things, to maintain all that capacity. Cause I think it's important to have all those things regardless of your age. I set up a thing called the carnivore training system where I kind of list all that. I've got a nice training workout that people utilize that want to do that stuff. But that's kind of my training philosophy in general. Like I said, I've taken from a number of world champion athletes in a number of different sports that I've trained with, I've kind of combined that to my approach, which, I think arguably works pretty well.
So do you think your results that you get in are based on the combination of both the diet and the exercise, or would you see one as being, are both just as important, or what if you were to trade one off, what would you say is a good foundation for people? Should they focus on their diet or should they focus on their exercise, just from your perspective?
Yeah, well, I think it partly depends upon where somebody's starting. I think if someone's starting, very obese, very out of shape, then I think you've got to put diet in place first. You've got to redefine your relationship with food. You've got to get on a healthy diet. Long-term, I think both need to be in place. But I think if I were to start, if I was, an overweight, 50-year-old guy that was, 30 kilos overweight, I would start with diet first. That's where I would start first, because I think a lot of times people get in there, they get in an exercise routine, and it's not fun because they don't feel good. Their joints hurt. It tires them out. They're not enjoying it. They can't do what other people do. And so it's very depressing. And so they quit. So I'd rather see someone start with diet first, get their nutrition on point, fix their metabolic problems, fix their health. And then what will almost naturally happen is they'll feel like they want to get out there and their body has energy. It's tough to exercise when you have no energy. And I know people say, well, it's just being lazy. But I think truly there are people out there that it's really a physical struggle. I mean, when I get up in the morning, I'm good. I'm full of energy, ready to go. I'm looking forward to exercise. I'm looking forward to doing my exercise later today. And I look forward to that stuff. And I think it's part of it just because, I'm actually healthy from a nutritional standpoint. So I think they are both incredibly important, but I would start with diet.
Do you have any other stuff in your life, any other practices, protocols that you feel contribute to your overall sort of health profile at the moment? Do you meditate? Is there any mindfulness stuff? Is there a certain time that you spend in the sun? Are you into biohacking? Do you take any supplements? What's your sort of outlook on any of those? Anything else to add?
Yeah, I mean, I think those things, in general, I think there are things beyond nutrition and exercise that we can do. I do think, humans are outdoor creatures. I think we weren't designed to sit in dark rooms. And, I know as you're sitting there in a dark room.
I've got my salt lamp next to me, Sean. It's getting those negative ions off on me, I hope.
Right. But I mean, I think that we are designed to be outside in the sun as much as possible. I do try to do that. If I can get outside and exercise, I'll do that. Like I said, I've got my rowing machine when the weather allows outside in the sun. I like to get out, take walks. I think, having some time away from the stress of day-to-day life is incredibly important. I think getting adequate sleep is important. Getting good, restful sleep is important. I think having a routine where you've got, if you can. Now, some people work crazy job hours and they can't do it, but if you can, getting into a regular sleep pattern, realizing it's a vital part of your health. I played with, cold immersion. I think that can be a benefit. How much, I'm not sure. As far as meditation goes, yeah, it's probably helpful and a lot of people benefit. I don't do it. It's not something that I have time for, I guess. Maybe I could make more time for it. Perhaps I should, but it's something that, you know, like I said, you've only got a limited number of hours in the day. You can't spend your entire day meditating, optimizing. You know, you've got to actually live your life and do the things you've got to do. So you have to pick your, you know, pick your emphasis. And for me, the emphasis is on diet and exercise are my two major focuses. And then quickly behind that would be sleep. And then behind that would be these other things, getting outdoors and that sort of stuff. And so, yes, I mean, the short answer is yes, I think those things are important. What's the relative importance of that stuff? You know, I think it's probably a little less important than diet is, for sure, in my view.
Yeah, I think it's like you said, it can be a trap that you can easily fall into, especially from the background I'm in, which is kind of like the biohacking world and some of the more spiritual practices as well. Sometimes it's easy to get caught up in just doing it and just constantly optimizing yourself, but you haven't really got anything to optimize yourself for. You're just in that perpetual state of optimization, and you don't actually live life. So your life is just optimizing yourself without actually experiencing what you're doing it for. And I think that was a good point. And in terms of just finding your sort of golden mean between everything and finding what's going to work for you and allow you to live life and enjoy it as well as being optimal at the same time. And I think that's very important.
Yeah. You have to have experiences. I mean, you know, no one's going to go to their graveyard saying, I wish I'd optimized more. You know, I mean, I sort of see that. Most people are going to say, I wish I'd done this or visited there or spent time with my family or developed these relationships. I mean, it's, you know, no one's out there, you know, saying, I wish I'd have watched more TV or spent more time biohacking. I mean, there may be some people that die of illness that should have done at least some level of that. But I do think there's a point where you reach where, I had Mark Sisson on my podcast a while ago, and I think he's got a pretty good philosophy. You know, he seeks to just get maximum enjoyment out of every day. And if that means you're strapping yourself to a feedback device 24 hours a day and constantly calculating stuff, how much enjoyment are you getting out of life? And I think there's, you know, like when you talk about spirituality, I think that part goes into, you know, what am I alive for? Why am I here? And I think part of that is just to have a positive experience for the most part, whether it's positive in your own experience or being a positive influence on other people.
Yeah, I think that's one of the unspoken truths of spirituality. That is what it's about. It's about experience, and it's about having a good impact on other people's lives as well. And it's you normally only succeed in that if you're fulfilling your own purpose and living your life and enjoying it. And you can easily get caught up within, like I said just a minute ago, optimizing or just picking like kind of dividing yourself from others, be it vegan, be it carnivore, be it paleo, be it whatever. It's always that divide, separation, us versus them mentality. And once you get out of that, just kind of take people for being people, I feel like that's a much more holistic path to walk down. But Sean, I've just got my eye on the time now, and we've racked up a good hour, and I appreciate your time, man. So I think what we'll do is tie this one in here. I really enjoyed it, man, and it's good to get to the bottom of your views on just on health, your perspective on the whole carnivore trend and movement that's happening now. I had Brian Sanders on the podcast a few episodes back. I know that you're going to be on his new documentary Food Lies, which I'm really looking forward to seeing how that turns out. And Brian's doing great work over there, and everyone involved within that project is going to be a big influence in getting this sort of information out there for people, because there's a lot of misinformation, disinformation, and just bullshit in general when it comes to nutritional science, which kind of broadly speaking, like you said, is kind of bullshit. So it's great to have you doing what you do, and hopefully everyone's really enjoyed this episode. And for everyone that has, whereabouts can they find more of you, Sean? You mentioned that you've got your podcast, you've got like your social media tags, your website, I know you got your training plan as well that you've got going on. If you want to say all of that, and then of course I'll throw that all into the show notes as well, but just for you to be able to tell the people now.
Yeah, sure. So, I'm pretty active on social media. Probably Instagram is where I've got a lot of my stuff. So that's Sean, S-H-A-W-N, Baker, B-A-K-E-R, 1967. I do quite a bit of stuff on Twitter, S-Baker-M-D. I've got a YouTube channel, Sean Baker. I think you type in Sean Baker Carnivore, it'll come up. I've got, we've got the World Carnivore Tribe Facebook group, which I started, which is now 27,000 members. We started that just over a year ago, so we're growing pretty tremendously. I've got, the book coming out, The Carnivore Diet, which is available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble for pre-order. I know it's going to be released worldwide, so you should be able to get it in the UK.
When's the book out, Sean?
I'm not 100% sure. It's probably going to be out either late spring or early summer, is my understanding. Still kind of the publisher's still finishing up on some stuff, and it's out of my hands at this point.
But okay.
That's when I think it's coming out. Human Performance Outliers podcast. Myself and Zach Better do that. We've got some, pretty good information there. Sean-Baker.com. And what else? I think that's enough, man. I got too much stuff going on.
plenty of ways for people to get in touch.
Yeah, plenty of ways to see. You can go to any vegan YouTube channel and you can see people screaming about how awful of a person I am, probably. you want to get some many-sided views on me, but interesting.
Yeah, you got quite the bullseye on you, Sean. Quite the target man. But it's there's no such thing as bad press, bad media. So it's all just bringing attention to your own work as well. And anyone who's got a little bit of rationality to them, they listen to you and they're like, fuck, man, this guy's not as bad as these pages have been making him out to be. So, yeah, I really do thank you, Sean, for coming on and appreciate your time. And let's tie this one up then, guys. So you've got all Sean's details. Hopefully you really enjoyed this one, gave you a bit of a clearer insight into the whole carnivore movement, something for you to look into more. Again, check out Sean's podcast, check out his Instagram, plenty more information, plenty more of check out his book as well. Sean, I'm probably going to pick that one up as well when it comes out in the UK and give that a read and see what it's saying. And yeah, I think that's going to be great. So right, that's episode, what are we on, 43 now? Fuck. Episode 43, guys. So that's episode 43. Man, this is going quick. I still remember, it only feels like yesterday that I had that first episode out. So yeah, guys, hopefully you're enjoying it so far. Plenty more good episodes to come. As always, stay woke as fuck, and I'll catch you on the next episode.